This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Megan Rapinoe, is an icon as a champion soccer player and as an activist. Last year, after the U.S. national women's soccer team won their fourth World Cup, she was awarded the Golden Boot for top scorer and the Golden Ball for the tournament's best player. She's been co-captain of the team since 2018. Rapinoe also helped her team win a gold medal at the 2012 Olympics. For a while, she was practically the only openly gay player on the U.S. women's national team, which put her in the spotlight as an LGBTQ activist. She's fought for equal pay in women's soccer and was part of a lawsuit against the U.S. Soccer Federation. This past spring, a federal judge dismissed the team's claim, but the team plans to file an appeal. In 2016, a week after Colin Kaepernick took a knee during the national anthem, Rapinoe took a knee in support and faced the consequences. Now she's written a new memoir called One Life. She recently announced her engagement to Sue Bird, a champion player in the WNBA. Megan Rapinoe, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on your engagement. How much have things changed since you first came out, like nearly 10 years ago?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Thank you for the congratulations, of course. I think in so many ways, you know, we're further along and we're in a better place. And in so many ways, we're sort of exactly where we were. Obviously, this administration this current administration is posing a threat to that in their sort of legislation and values and the direction they want to go. It's always a balance for me. I find that while it feels like we're so much further, you know, the fact that, you know, LGBTQ people have only been allowed to marry in this country for 5 years, that sort of stands in stark opposition to it. So on the one hand, I feel like we're going in the right direction. And on the other hand, I think we have a lot of work left to do.
Because of COVID, the Olympics have been postponed, the World Cup has been canceled. How disappointing is that for you? Like, what does that mean in terms of your career?
Well, it really threw a pretty big variable in there, especially being an athlete, not really on the younger side of things. And so I think by the time the Olympics were actually postponed or the announcement was made, we had sort of long understood that nothing was going to be happening, certainly not this summer. But in the same sense, it sort of threw our entire life up in the air like confetti. It was like, we don't, you know, normally for athletes, especially you're on a schedule pretty much year round, even when it's your off time, that's scheduled off time. And everything is pretty, you know, regulated, you know, where you're traveling, you know, where you're going to be, you know, the different phases of training you're going to be in, you kind of have things, you know, pretty much markered in for the entire year. And so obviously with a pandemic like this, much like everybody in the country, it was a sort of standstill and you can't really plan anything. In a lot of ways, the disappointment of not being able to play sports was so secondary compared to, you know, the devastation that was happening across the country and so many people being affected so negatively. I think in a big way, we were just, you know, in the collective anxiety of the country at the time. And now that things have, you know, I guess we understand, it's not that things have gotten better, certainly not by any measure, but I think we understand it a little bit better. I mean, obviously Sue played in the WNBA bubble this summer, and I think, you know, my league did a good job this summer, and with the national team, we're still kind of waiting and seeing. But I think it's like there's some things you can control and some things you can't, and this obviously was not one that we could control, and we just tried to, you know, to lean into that and do as much as we could with what we could.
You've helped turn women's soccer into a very popular sport in the U.S., and you've helped pave the way for more equity in women's sports. Give us a sense of some of the disparities between how men and women have been paid in soccer and how they've been treated.
The amount of money that we could possibly earn in our contract compared to the amount of money that the men could possibly earn in the contract is very different. I think a lot is made about the guaranteed money in our contract and the different compensation structures that we have. But when you look at the possibility of money for each team, ours is vastly, vastly lower than the men.
Yeah, and you were on a championship women's team, and the men's team was a losing team, and they were getting paid so much more than you were.
Yeah, and I think that was something that, you know, in the latest court ruling, we felt that the court really didn't fully appreciate. We'll just say for round number's sake, if we capture 90% of our, you know, the total compensation available in our contract, and you know the men only captured 50% of it, we earned about the same dollar for dollar amount. Meanwhile, we've won, you know, 2 World Cups. We've won nearly every friendly that we've played in. We've won all the tournaments. We've been very successfully, both commercially, marketing wise, sponsorships and branding and all that, and obviously been very successful on the field. And so it's kind of the, you know, work twice as hard or win twice as much or be twice as successful and to get paid, you know, about the same dollar for dollar amount. That's sort of at the heart of pay inequity and gender discrimination, we feel.
So, you know, we've been talking about women's soccer and some of the inequities in like men's and women's sports. When you started playing soccer when you were around 6, there wasn't like a girls' team for you to be part of. So you and your twin sister became members of the boys' team. How did it feel for you as a girl to be on the boys' team? Because, you know, another thing you say in your book is that you don't think you ever dominated a team the way you dominated that boys' team when you were a child. And, you know, I'm also wondering, like, did the boys really appreciate that? Like, she's really great and she's on our team. Or did they think it was weird or maybe even uncomfortable that a girl was, like, beating them? You know, you were on the same team, but you were better than they were.
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think I ever really, really thought about it, probably until, you know, 5th or 6th grade. I think that's when, you know, gender lines are drawn more clearly. Because, you know, all growing up, we played with each other, we played with boys. It was, you know, during recess, during, you know, intramural sports or whatever it may be, sort of our town sports. It was just kind of like what it was. And I think from a very early age, my sister Rachel and I were always the best. Like, there was no question. So it wasn't like, you know, we were coming up against these boys and kind of holding our own or kind of not. We were kind of kicking everyone's butt. So I don't think the boys even looked at us like, oh, these are girls and we're not supposed to lose to girls. It's kind of like, well, yeah, those are the twins and like they're better than everyone. It was interesting, actually. I think that we were maybe 11 or 12. We played on a boys team that traveled to Sacramento. So we're from a pretty small town in Northern California called Redding. It's about 2.5 hours drive from Sacramento to a town that, you know, I think because they have so many kids and the sports programs were a lot better, the soccer programs were a lot better, they were split up by boys and girls, I'm sure, a lot earlier. But ours was kind of like, well, let's just get the best, you know, 20 kids that we can find and we'll just work with that. But the parents on the other team and even the boys on the other team were really kind of taken aback by it. You know, comments coming from the parents on the sideline, oh, don't let that girl beat you. Or the boys, you could just tell on the other team, were just uncomfortable with the fact that they were being beaten or being bettered by a girl. But that was kind of the first time I sort of realized like, oh, these parents are not used to this. And clearly this is something that they should look a little deeper into because they seem quite upset.
You're right that you knew you were never going to be the fastest player or the strongest player, so you had to develop a style rooted in something other than beating people through physical force. Do you think thinking that you wouldn't be like the strongest or the fastest helped you develop your footwork?
Oh yeah, definitely. I think it helped me develop not just my footwork, but my awareness in the game. I mean, obviously the ultimate goal in soccer is to, you know, get the ball and score. Some people can outrun everyone. Some people are better understanding spatial awareness. I think I was good at that. I think I was understanding, you know, how I could make space for myself in a sort of a strategic way. I mean, I think I'm athletic enough, obviously, to be able to, you know, run fast and do things. But I think I just developed other parts of my game that no matter how fast you are, how strong you are, you can still be really successful if you're creative with the game, if you have good vision, if you know how to get open, if you know how to pull defenses apart, if you can anticipate all of those kinds of things.
You were one of the first women on the U.S. national women's soccer team to come out. Although you say there were plenty of other women who were gay, but not out. You say you were one of the only gay players at the time, which is hilarious considering how many gay people were really on the team. So yes. What made you decide like you were going to publicly come out?
You know, I honestly felt like, I mean, even going back to when I first sort of discovered I was gay myself, which happened very shortly after I got to college, I never struggled with that. I was actually thrilled. I thought, okay, this is awesome. I felt like my whole life sort of like clicked into place. And it just gave me this whole new sense of myself. And just this confidence, I think, kind of bloomed and exploded in me. It was during, I mean, I think at the time, maybe just before that Prop 8 had been on the ballot in California, I'm from California. You know, generally, I think these cases were coming before the Supreme Court. And it just kind of came like, why am I not out? I didn't really have a lot of, you know, interaction with media where I had to hide it or what, you know, nobody was asking. That's not really an appropriate question to ask someone. But it just became one of those things where I did start to notice myself saying some things and not others. And I just was like, what am I doing? Like, why am I even doing that? And why am I not out knowing that it could probably have a really positive impact? And so I just kind of made the decision. It was actually on the plane ride home from that 2011 World Cup. I was sitting next to my friend Lori, who's also out and played on the team for a long time. It was just, yeah, it just kind of became like, why am I not out? This is not feeling right. And so I took, I think, a couple months to sort of figure out exactly what I wanted to do, and then came out before the London Olympics in 2012.
And what changed afterwards?
Publicly, I think a lot changed. I still, to this day, have, you know, people coming up to me or writing to me or whatever it may be, you know, thanking me or saying, you know, I'm the reason they felt okay with themselves, or I'm the reason their family was okay, or, you know, parents coming up to me who, you know, very clearly have little budding gay children. And even if it's an unspoken thing, it's, they see themselves in me. They see a future for their children that isn't, you know, just all about the stereotype that you hear, which is how hard life is to be gay. And not to say that life isn't difficult being gay for a lot of people, it really is, but it's not all bad. It's not all struggle. Whenever I go into a room, like, we don't have to talk about the fact that I'm gay, or an interview or whatever. It doesn't have to be all about that, but I'm very out and proud and will show that and will live a very out and open life. And I think that that's vital for people to see.
I think Sue Bird, who you're engaged to and who is a WNBA star, I think she was not out when you started your relationship. Did you convince her to come out?
You know, it's funny, the one of the first things that my twin sister said was, is Sue out? And I was like, no, she's not out. Like, she's obviously out with her family and friends and all of that, but not with the media. And she was like, well, she's not going to be able to hide this for very long. You're like the gayest thing ever. So, which is so true. It's like, I mean, even though we're only 5 years apart, that age difference in terms of, you know, the national dialogue or what it was like for her in college compared to what it was like for me in college is so vastly different. It's almost like we're a generation apart in that way of how society was thinking about gay and talking about gay. And so in a way, I think it was just like she got to this place, she was fine with her family, fine with her friends. She never really like struggled with it all that much, but it was like, you know, just kind of something that she's more private in general. But yeah, once Big Gay Megan came onto the scene, she had to make a decision very quickly, I think.
One of the things you write about in your memoir is your older brother. He's the person who kind of got you started in soccer because he's older than you are and was playing before you played and got you interested in the sport. When he was in his teens, he started using drugs, opioids, meth, then heroin. And he spent a lot of time in and out of prison and spent a lot of time in solitary confinement. And you write that there was a period when he joined a white supremacist gang inside prison and came home with a swastika tattoo. Have you been able to reconcile the person he became in prison and the brother that you grew up with?
I mean, I think that we do not understand, as people who have never been in prison, I don't think we really understand prison society. It's very different from normal society. Not like a, you know, a whole scale excuse for anybody who does anything bad in prison, but I think that the rules are different. I think also like multiple things can be true at one time. Things are complicated. So maybe that is where he found, you know, a sense of community, or he found a sense of belonging, or just protection. I mean, I think if your life is on the line, I think pretty much anybody would do anything in their power to save it. And so while it was just baffling and sort of devastating to even know that, it was like, okay, well, what does it mean? And talk to us about it. Why did you do this? And like, this is frankly insane. And I think for him too, understanding that, you know, I think especially in California, because it's so racially diverse, I think that a lot of the tension, the tension between the groups was wanted by the prison system to sort of keep everybody in line. It's like, as long as all the prisoners are fighting each other, they're not going to organize and fight against the system that's oppressing them all and locking them away forever and ruining lives. And so I think he kind of started to realize through his journey, oh, maybe this is, you know, we're all fighting amongst each other, but maybe we really should be fighting against the prison system, or against mass incarceration, or the drug laws, or the three strikes rule, or whatever the reason everybody was in there. And so, you know, it's never excusable, ever. And, you know, white supremacy is just as dark of, you know, a human belief that you could possibly have. But I want to understand it better rather than just say, you know, holy shit, you're white supremacist, like I'm never going to talk to you again.
Is he comfortable with you writing about him?
So I think sometimes, I'm sure sometimes he's not. Probably in the better times he is. You know, it's difficult because I feel like when he gets really sober, you know, he's about all these things. He was working really hard and, you know, getting his education. He was doing a lot of work with criminal justice reform. He was doing a lot of work, even in like racial equity and talking about things and breaking down some of these, you know, beliefs that maybe he had with himself. And he was doing really amazing work. We were aligned, you know, from a philosophical perspective and how we see the world in so many ways. And then there's another person. There's a person who's addicted to drugs and who gets strung out and who, you know, just does what they can to survive, and to survive through the daily horrors that is addiction. And so I think in some ways probably yes, and in some ways probably not.
We're living in a very divisive time. You got a lot of criticism in addition to a lot of praise for taking a knee shortly after Colin Kaepernick did. So you represent American teams in the Olympics and in the World Cup. What does the flag mean to you? What does, like, you know, American pride, national pride mean to you?
I see American pride, or at least my personal pride, or what I think that the flag should mean, is like an impossible standard in which we are always trying to get to. Like, we're not there. We were never there. First of all, the country was, you know, founded not on freedom and liberty and justice for all. I think we can just start to be very honest with ourselves about that. It doesn't mean that we don't have some of those qualities and that we can work towards some of those qualities, but this country was founded on chattel slavery and the brutal and ruthless system of slavery. So let's just like all be really honest about that. So when I look at the flag, what I want to see is us constantly trying to live up to these words and live up to this ideal where all people are free and all people do have all of the rights and all people can have a life filled with liberty and justice for all, and who, you know, work hard and have a good life and all of these things. But I think we just so clearly have so far to go. And so I see patriotism as constantly demanding better of ourselves.
You said that one of the things that sets the U.S. team apart is that you always believe that you'll win. And in fact, like, we believe that we will win is even a chant at your games. So is that how you're naturally inclined, or did you have to fool yourself into thinking, into actually believing that you will win? And can you teach me how to do that? I'm such, I am not, like, yes, I know I will be great. I know I will win.
You know, it took some time. I think coming onto the team at a young age, you realize very quickly, well, first of all, we do win a lot. So that is what you become accustomed to, but it goes deeper. We win a lot because we really, truly, deep down believe that we're going to win. I think that comes from battling against each other all the time and understanding that it takes more than just a desire to win. You know, it takes a belief, it takes a determination, and it takes a hard work, it takes a trust, and it takes a vulnerability with each other to show up in that way and to be able to kind of lay it out all on the line all the time. I've been in so many games, honestly, where I feel like the other team is too insecure to show how much they want to win. And so they just don't. There's no insecurity on our team about that. It's like, we will, I mean, embarrass ourselves to the nth degree to win a game, I think. Like, we would go that far because it's just...
Wait, what do you do to embarrass yourself to win?
And we don't care if we're down 4-0. We will never give up. We don't care if we look stupid or whatever. Like, we just focus on winning and never giving up. I think it's more of the never giving up part.
Megan Rapinoe, thank you so much for talking with us, and congratulations again on your engagement and also on the new book.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Megan Rapinoe's new memoir is called One Life. Harvard is a place that's especially aware of tradition and of its own past. But as Becky Cooper learned, some Harvard stories are whispered, not celebrated. Cooper's new book, We Keep the Dead Close, is a true crime story about the murder of a Harvard graduate student. Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, has a review.
The murder scene looked like something out of an Agatha Christie novel. That's the one thing that the multitudinous cast of witnesses, suspects, and police detectives might agree on in We Keep the Dead Close, Becky Cooper's just-published account of a murder at Harvard that took place in 1969 and remained unsolved until 2 years ago. The victim was a 23-year-old graduate student in the anthropology department. Her name was Jane Britton. On the morning of January 7th, 1969, her boyfriend, a fellow grad student, became concerned when Jane failed to show up at a lecture hall in Harvard's Peabody Museum. Fellow grad students that morning were sweating through exams. When Jane's boyfriend finished his own exam, he walked over to her apartment in a dilapidated, poorly secured building owned by Harvard. There, he discovered Jane splayed out face down on her mattress, which was covered in blood. Jane had been bludgeoned to death, perhaps with something small and sharp, like one of the archaeological tools she'd used on a dig in Iran that past summer. Scattered around Jane's body was what looked to be red ochre, a powdery iron ore substance that's been found in ancient burial sites around the world. Adding to the ritualistic atmosphere of the murder scene was the fact that a piece of a colonial grave marker was also placed by Jane's body. Becky Cooper first heard about the murder in 2009 when she was an undergrad at Harvard. As she writes, "From the moment I heard the story, so much about it barbed me." Cooper would go on to spend over a decade investigating the cold case. After graduation, she eventually joined the editorial staff of The New Yorker. But as her involvement with the case deepened, Cooper would leave that job, moving on to Harvard's campus as a resident advisor, and even embarking herself on an archaeological dig in Bulgaria, all in an effort to get closer to the crime and its victim. The result is an over 400-page true crime book that's overstuffed with suspects, motives, red herrings, and interviews, as well as Cooper's first-person meditations about her own fascination with the case. Reading We Keep the Dead Close is akin to what I imagine it would be like to dive into a trench at an archaeological site and start digging, not with a trowel, but with a snow shovel. Cooper unearths tons of information here, but not every artifact deserves preserving. Indeed, by the time the case is closed in 2018, thanks to new developments in DNA testing, there's a feeling of exhaustion rather than satisfaction. Had Cooper sifted more judiciously through this detail, We Keep the Dead Close would have been a more memorable true crime narrative. But even in its unfiltered state, the book offers a vivid profile of one of the most prominent villains of this piece, one that to a degree still remains at large. That would be the sexist culture of academe, particularly at its most elite levels. Cooper tells us that in 2009, when she first heard about Jane Britton's murder, the body was nameless, just another girl found dead. Even as she comes to learn so much about Jane's personality and family background, Cooper learns other things. For instance, that female grad students in Harvard's anthropology department, until recently, kept a secret file on Jane's murder that they handed down from one class to the next, and that they viewed her murder as a cautionary tale about the dangers that faced women in academe. Cooper says Jane's story was still so alive in the community because it was an exaggerated horror movie version of a narrative that was all too common. Consider this. One of the prime murder suspects for a time was Jane's advisor. Cooper interviewed that now elderly professor, and he told her that after Jane's death, he received a call from the dean, who offered him Harvard's full support without reservation. Cooper recalls the professor grinned as he added, "The dean didn't even ask me if I did it." True crime isn't a particularly female literary preserve, but I think there's often an added element of identification when a woman writes about another woman's unsolved death. A recent example would be Emma Copley Eisenberg's The Third Rainbow Girl, about the 1980 double murder of two young women in Appalachia. Like Eisenberg, Cooper is an obsessive and identifies fiercely with her subject. Even when this book threatens to buckle under the weight of detail, Cooper's resolve to excavate the truth about Jane's murder will keep a reader engaged enough to want to follow this case to its unexpected conclusion.
Maureen Carrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed We Keep the Dead Close by Becky Cooper. The COVID pandemic has made us more conscious of smell. The loss of the sense of smell is a common symptom of COVID, and wearing masks to prevent the spread of COVID has made many of us more conscious than we'd like to be of the smell of our own breath, which gets trapped and amplified by the mask. My guest, Harold McGee, is the author of the new book, Nosedive, A Field Guide to the World's Smells. It helps explain everything from bad breath to why the beef from grass-fed cows tastes different from that of cows fed grain, and why sweaty feet can smell kind of cheesy. Harold McGee is famous in the food world for his books and articles on the science of cooking. His book on food and cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen, has been described as a Bible for home chefs around the world. His writings about food and science have also inspired restaurant chefs in the food avant-garde. McGee is a visiting lecturer in Harvard University's course, Science and Cooking, From Haute Cuisine to Soft Matter Science. Harold McGee, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much, Terry. It's great to be back.
It's a pleasure to have you back. So let's start with mask breath. The mask creates a feedback loop with your breath. You're like, you're smelling your breath, and then you're talking, and there's more breath trapped in the mask. So why do we get bad breath?
Well, we get bad breath because we have a thriving microbiome in our mouth. In fact, our skin, our innards are all homes to microbes that have learned to live in those environments. And the microbes in our mouth thrive by consuming the remains of what we've been eating, as well as the shed cells and things like that, proteins in our saliva and that kind of thing. And when they do that, they produce small molecules, molecules that are small enough to be volatile, that is to say, to fly out into the air where we can smell them. And so what we're smelling when we smell our breath is the smell of the microbes that we're hosts to and feeding.
Smell is sometimes so subjective, you know, as you point out in the book, like some cheese smells very similar to vomit. We love the cheese, but the smell of vomit makes you want to puke yourself. So why do they smell kind of similar? And why is our reaction to that smell so different? You know, depending on whether it's puke or, you know, ripe cheese.
Yes. Yeah, no, it's absolutely true. And the reason that there is that kind of crossover is that both of those materials, the cheese and the vomit, contain a number of different volatile molecules that we can smell, but one of the most prominent in both of them is butyric acid, which is a breakdown product, a small fragment of ordinary fats that we find in foods of all kinds, especially cheese, which is very rich in animal fats. And so when cheeses are fermented by microbes, those microbes, in the process of the fermentation, break down some of the animal fats, the beef fats, milk fats, into butyric acid. And that's an element of the flavor, which actually becomes stronger and stronger with time. There's also butyric acid in vomit because stuff that we have upchucked has been in our stomach. We've been breaking it down into its components, and butyric acid is a prominent component in almost everything we have. So there's that echo is from that molecule and maybe a few others. And our reaction to that molecule is dependent on the context. You know, if we're sitting down at a table and cutting ourselves a piece of cheese, it's a nice kind of accent in the flavor of that cheese. If we're feeling really sick and, you know, staring at a toilet, then it's a very different context.
Okay. One of the incidents that got you started on the science of smell was eating grouse on one of your, you know, food trips abroad. And grouse is a wild game bird. I can't say I've ever tasted it. So tell us a little bit about what grouse is and why tasting it left you absolutely speechless.
Yeah, it was an experience. So grouse they're kind of like bluefish in this country, or matsutake mushrooms, or morels in the springtime. They're very much a seasonal food. You can only get this bird for a few months in the late summer, early fall. I happened to be in England during that period. I'd never tasted grouse before. I knew it existed. It had this kind of, Woodhouse Jeevesy kind of aura around it for me anyway, because it is so English. And so I made sure to get a taste of it. I went to lunch at a restaurant that was serving it and was talking with the people with me at the table, and took my first bite, and I was actually momentarily paralyzed. I was in the middle of saying something. I stopped. I just couldn't. I was really confused. I'd never felt that way eating anything. And the people I was with looked at me and thought, you know, told me afterwards, they thought maybe I was having a stroke or something.
I shouldn't be laughing. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a really striking experience. And what it got me to thinking about was, of course, why could a bite of food have that kind of effect on me? What was going on? So I learned about grouse. I should, though, first of all, say that the flavor that knocked me out like that was the meatiest, most intense, most kind of animal-like flavor that I'd ever experienced before. I'd had, you know, things like duck, which is a rich bird, and was kind of expecting something along those lines. But this was really funky. It was almost as if it were slightly off. And I think that's part of the reason my brain decided to pay all of its attention to the bird and not to my companions. They wanted to make sure that it was okay to swallow. So I decided to learn about grouse, and it turns out that they are wild birds. They live on the heath in the north of England. They eat scrubby, very tannic, to us unpleasant heath vegetation. They're prone to get parasites, which allow animals that hunt them to find them more easily. When they're shot, they're actually kept in a cool room for several days to mature them with the guts intact, sometimes those guts including parasites. So the flavor of the whole bird becomes kind of imbued with the stuff that's in the digestive system, maybe the parasites that are in the digestive system. All that contributes to the aroma of the bird. And then the bird is cooked very briefly, so it's very rare. And just, as I say, an extremely strong, funky flavor. That's what got my attention and kind of pushed me off on this trek to find out about smells.
Not only does that sound kind of disgusting to me, it sounds unhealthy.
Well, yeah, it's been done long enough that I didn't worry too much about the health consequences. It's not the most hygienic of preparations, and in fact, I think that the disgust that you're registering, I think, was actually part of my experience. Then it was a mixture of interest and disgust. And I think afterwards, the way I interpreted it was that it was really my first experience with what it means to eat animal flesh. You know, when we buy meat these days, it's been prepackaged, and we don't really know anything about where it came from. It smells like nothing, but this is animal flesh as our ancestors would have eaten it, and it was an encounter with the necessity that for us to eat meat, an animal has to die. That's kind of what it came down to, and that's kind of what I was tasting in that moment.
So we've been talking about the like shocking taste of grouse, and you say that part of the reason why grouse tastes different than, say, like, you know, duck or, you know, other birds or poultry has to do with what the grouse eats before it's killed. And that's apparently true of a lot of the food that we eat, that the taste depends on what the animal or the bird has eaten. So what's the difference between how grass-fed meat, the meat from grass-fed cows, compares to cows that have been fed grain?
So it's absolutely true that the foods that animals eat in order to grow affect the way they taste when we in turn eat them as food. And in the case of grass and grain-fed animals, the difference is in the kinds of fat that they take in. So it's not that we're actually tasting grass or tasting grain when we detect a difference between the two. It's actually the fact that the fats, the oils in grass, are very irregular molecules, and they tend to be broken down in the animal into particular fragments that are very characteristic of those original fats and oils. When we feed animals with grain, we give them a very different diet. The fats and oils in grains are very different from the fats and oils in the grass. The other thing about a grain diet is that it's a much richer diet, of course, than pasture feeding. And so the tissue is much fattier, the meat is much fattier, and we're tasting predominantly the fats from the grains. When we have grass-fed beef, it's much leaner. They're just different. And different people in different countries have different preferences. We in America tend to prefer the flavor of grain-fed beef because that's what we've been used to for decades now. But in other parts of the world, in South America, where a lot of beef is raised, and in Europe, the flavor of grass-fed beef is much preferred.
You know, you write that fish farmers are experimenting with what to feed the fish to make the fish taste better. What are some of those experiments like?
Well, it's interesting. They're in fact, trying out better ways to make fish, in a sense, taste fishier, because aquaculture is becoming more and more important for sparing the wild populations in the oceans. Many of the animals, many of the fish in the oceans eat other fish. And so it doesn't really do that much good if you're going to culture fish, raise fish outside of the oceans or in confined areas in the oceans, but then go ahead and feed them all the fish that they would have been eating from the rest of the ocean. So they're trying to find feeds that will be more sustainable in aquaculture, and that usually means plant-based materials. And so the trick is to feed the fish with materials that will end up giving the fish the same fragments that we can smell and taste that having a wild diet would. And that turns out to be a challenge.
We've been talking about taste. Your book is about the sense of smell. So where does smell figure into this?
Well, the difference is actually a difference in smells and not in taste. So, and this is where the English language kind of does us wrong, because we talk about taste and flavor as being kind of the same thing in some circumstances. But if we distinguish between taste, which is the sensations we get on our tongue, and smell, which are the sensations we get in the nose, then it's actually the smells of foods that make them as distinctive as they are. So animals, plants, all the things around us that are alive that we end up eating in one form or another, they're made up for the most part of very large molecules, proteins, fats, starches, things like that, which themselves have no smell. They are large molecules, and for a molecule to be smellable, it has to be small, small enough to escape whatever it's in, fly through the air into our noses where we can detect them. The diet of the animals provides the animals with large molecules, which the animals then break down into smaller ones, and it's those particular groups of smaller ones that constitute the aroma of the food that we're eating.
Why does cooking bring out the aroma of food?
Well, it does so, in fact, by kind of doing what it is that microbes are doing in fermented foods and inside us. It's breaking down these large, complicated molecules like proteins and fats, which are too big to have an aroma because they're not able to fly through the air and reach our nose. Cooking using heat, energy, breaks apart those large molecules into smaller ones, and those smaller ones are what we experience as the typical aromas of cooking foods.
Yes, I'm really getting a sense that what we smell affects how we taste, and what we smell is a function of a unique combination of a whole bunch of different molecules. It sounds like there must be an infinite variety of these molecules, which is what contributes to so many different aromas and tastes.
Yeah, it's. I don't know that it's infinite, but it's a very large number, for sure. And that's something just in general worth knowing about smells, is that we think, for example, of the smell of blackcurrant jelly or of cat pee as being a specific smell. But in fact, it's more like a chord in music. There are many, many notes that are contributing to that overall sensation that we get. We pay attention only to the chord. We just, you know, recognize that's cat pee and I'm going to go in the other direction. But it's possible with some effort to sit there and kind of dissect a few notes out so that you can begin to appreciate the complexity of that overall chord.
Harold McGee, thank you so much for coming back to our show. It's really been a pleasure.
For me too, Terry. Thanks so much.
Harold McGee is the author of the new book, Nosedive, A Field Guide to the World's Smells.